Well, thanks for coming out in this weather. I mean, it's not much worse than it is in Pittsburgh, except that minus 13 sounds a lot worse than 13. But we do Fahrenheit, and as I was telling you, it's kilograms and kilometers and stuff. That's real easy, but because it's just a linear transformation. But Fahrenheit to centigrade is affine, and that's much more difficult. There's no really simple way to do this. All right, so how does the brain respond to stimuli? This is one of the fundamental questions in neuroscience. Transient behavior to arbitrary stimuli is very difficult to study. I mean, ultimately, that's what we'd like to be able to do, is study transient stuff, but we can't. I mean, we can do it by simulation and things like that. The nervous system tends to ignore constant and time inputs, and you can do a really simple experiment. Just hold your eyeball still and stare at, like, the clock or something, and the clock will fade away. It'll just disappear. The simplest non-constant inputs are periodic, and periodic stimuli can interact in real complex ways with the intrinsic activity and rhythmicity in the nervous system. And I'm going to show you some examples of this. So pathologies, I'm real interested in pathologies. Photic epilepsy, and probably some of you have heard of the Pokemon phenomena. There was like 300 or 400 kids in Japan that were watching an episode of Pokemon, and the flashing lights in there gave a whole lot of them seizures. You can give yourself seizures by going into a, looking at strobe lights and stuff like that. I had this device called the LSD flight simulator that was it was a little thing that you blew into, and it would cause a little disc to spin, and you could stare at the sun. It didn't work in Pittsburgh because we don't get sun. It's sort of like here or Seattle or something. But it always had a warning: if you have epilepsy, don't use this. Another thing is migraines, and people report internal flicker of the scotoma anywhere from 5 to 10 hertz. So there's this intrinsic rhythmicity in migraines. And two of the things I'm going to talk about today involve periodic stimulation of the visual system, and these are contour phosphenes and flicker hallucinations, or flicker phosphenes. So I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about contour phosphenes. When I was a grad student years and years and years and years ago, when he was young and I was younger, there was a paper that came out in the early 70s by this guy, R.H.S. Carpenter, who worked for the Royal Navy. And he did this experiment where he had volunteer subjects, because he's in the Navy, he could get volunteers very easily, okay? And they would stick their eye in a saline bath, and then that eye was stimulated with AC current at about 100 hertz. This is an incredibly painful stimulus, and it's something Dick Cheney might do. But I'm being recorded. I better be careful here. But this is Canada, right? Friendly Canada? Okay. I can always move back here. Okay, so, and there was a set of lenses and mirrors, and what happens is, while the eyeball's being stimulated, a bar moves across the visual field, okay? And it leaves in its wake these really cool contours. I'll show you some pictures of those in a second. Well, I was really fascinated by this, and this paper has only been cited 3 times in the entire 40 years that it's been in, out there. 2 times or 3 times. I think 2 of the times were papers that I wrote. And then the other one was another really bizarre theory for it. But as far as I know, this experiment's also never been repeated because it's probably pretty painful. But in any case, it fascinated me for years, and for years I was trying to figure out what could do it. But here's what happens. As the bar moves across your visual system, it leaves in its wake these contours, okay? And you can sort of see these are drawings that people have done, or the one subject or the few subjects that did it. And these, over time, slowly drift and meander. Another interesting thing is that the there's basically one line per cycle. It's just amazing. This is the velocity of the bar that moves across, and this is the inverse frequency, okay, and that fits right on a straight line, okay, and this is with a stimulus of 100 hertz. Spatial frequency versus temporal frequency, again, it fits perfectly on a line, okay, so there's this beautiful geometric relationship. Another thing is, if you have a limited sinusoidal stimulus, it results in a limited extent of these contours as the object moves across. And an advancing dark edge fails to produce the phosphenes. So, Carpenter, in the discussion in his book, he suggested two possible mechanisms. The lines seen under electrical stimulation are interference fringes resulting from differences in conduction times in different parts of the retina as a result of differences in the degree of illumination they receive. Okay? So he, later on in the discussion, completely eliminated this as being kind of like totally bogus. Okay? And I concur. It was kind of a weird theory. The other theory, he said, is these lines represent nodes separating areas of the retina that are responding in anti-phase to each other. The effect of a sudden increase in illumination is to give an extra jolt to the system sufficient to start a transient oscillation at the driving frequency. Well, that gets a little closer to what I think is going on here. Okay? About 20 years later, J.B. Willis published a paper on a bunch of different visual illusions, and he had this very complex bistability model that does not give symmetric domains. In other words, the regions here, if you look at these regions, this width is the same as this width is the same as this. They all have the same width, and his stuff did not give that, and also his model, unless you believe that these things, the light and the dark, are the actual two domains, and then they would be equal in width, and that wasn't seen either. So now I want to turn to what I think is going on. I think it's going on is, and this is why the name of this talk was Double or Nothing, is a lot of this talk is going to be concerned with period doubling types of phenomena that you see. Now, if you take... this is a human subject. If you subject them to uniform flicker and you look at the electroretinogram, for you mathematicians, you just stick an electrode near the, I guess, I don't know, do they stick it in the eye or not? No, next to the eye, okay. And it can pick up the electrical current, okay? So at 24 hertz, you can see, is this a one for one? Yeah, this is one for one, and this is a visual evoked potential, okay? You can see there you're getting one for one there, but as you speed things up, then you start to get rhythm skipping in the visual evoked potential. You lose a cycle. You get 2-to-1 locking, okay? And this is work of Marcus Meister in 1998. So one thing that's very... clear, and this should one thing that's really clear about period doubling is you automatically get bistability with it. What do I mean by bistability? You have two stable solutions when you have period doubling. You can fire on the odd cycle or you can fire on the even cycle, and those are two different solutions to the same equations. Okay, they're not simply because of symmetry, because of this minus one Floquet multiplier, you have this flipped symmetry, and you can get two different solutions. So this is an example of something called the Hodgkin-Huxley equations being periodically driven. For those of you, who are math guys, the Hodgkin-Huxley equations are sort of like Newton's law for neuroscientists. They were developed by Hodgkin and Huxley in the 50s. They got a Nobel Prize, not a Fields Medal because, we know mathematicians don't get Nobel Prizes because of Mittag Leffler, I guess, or something like that. But in any case, so here is an example. This red curve you see is actually two simulations that are basically superimposed, okay? And here's the light stimulus. There's a red stimulus, an orange stimulus, and a blue stimulus. And what happens is I give a little shock to the orange guy in addition to, I hyperpolarize it, bring it down a little bit in addition. And what happens is the red guy keeps firing on the same cycle he was before, but the same stimulus given a little bit later to the green guy shifts him to fire in antiphase, the opposite phase of the red guy. So I flipped this system from being synchronous to going out of phase with a transient stimulus because I have bistability that's intrinsic in that. So here's an example of a one-dimensional simulation. This is time, and this is maybe 20 or 100 oscillators. Okay, so this is 100 guys that are all being uniformly, periodically driven, and then what I do is I move a bar across them. Okay, so there's no coupling here, but you can see as the bar moves across, they flip into different domains. Okay, so all these guys are synchronized, but in antiphase with these. And the number of these clusters is exactly linearly proportional to 1 over the velocity. So right away, I get that line. And so what's going on here is that bar is moving across and grabbing, putting these guys into different basins of attraction as it moves. Okay? So that's what gives rise, what I think the contours you see are the domains between these two groups of cells or groups of things moving in antiphase. So I think this is probably occurring at the at the ganglion cell or even the bipolar cell. Now, in two dimensions, people found, what the experiments show is these contours actually move. They drift, they come together, and they disappear. Okay? So how do we include drifts? Here's some rules about this. One domain overtakes another, resulting in this slow drift. So this guy's, say, odd, this guy's even, and this guy starts to encroach on this one and takes over. This guy might encroach on this one, all right? So these guys are moving around a little bit. So the lines drift and merge. It can't be accounted for with just randomness, okay, because they're moving together. So what we assumed in this model was that there's local continuity but slowly varying heterogeneity. And if you do that, you need to have interactions. So what we assumed is we added something called gap junction coupling. Gap junction coupling is a very simple form of coupling between neurons. It just results from the coupling of the voltage differences. So for those of you who have done reaction diffusion equations, this is essentially the discrete analog of diffusion. And if you do that, you get movement, all right? Now, what's really cool about this is that if you guys know about bistable media, all right, bistable media, typically, if you couple a bistable medium with diffusion, you get a wave that propagates one way or the other. Maybe one guy takes over from the other, or the other guy takes over. All right, that's the classic model, not Fisher's equation, but the standard cubic reaction diffusion equation. Fife and McLeod in the early 70s proved existence of solutions to traveling waves to these things. But they always go in one direction or another. What's remarkable here is this is an isotropic medium, and this wave can propagate in two directions. Now, of course, there is an intrinsic symmetry, so the depth of the potential wells, if you want to think of bistability as a potential well, is exactly equal. There's no reason, there's no bias for odd versus even. So you get these nice traveling waves with and without bias. And in a few minutes, I'm going to try and explain why you get waves when there's no bias. So here's some simulations. I think this will work. So this is a simulation in 2D. You can see the bar moving across, and now it's left in its wake these two contours, or these, the, there's the contours, the white guys, and you can see the light blinking on and off, odd, even, okay? And so you can watch these two guys go together, and they'll merge and do exactly what you see in the experiments. This is one I really wanted to try, except that I'm kind of a chicken and I didn't really want the pain that was involved. It's sort of like migraines too. You know, you want to see the patterns, but you don't want the pain. All right. So here's an interesting phenomenon. Recall. Okay. So this is this led to some interesting mathematics. That the stuff I described to you was done by a PhD student who's now in New York. I'm doing a postdoc, and I had an undergrad, John Rubin and I had an undergrad come in, and we thought this is a really interesting thing, that in absence of isotropy, movement occurs, but in absence of anisotropy, movement occurs, and the wave can go in either direction. It's a bistable system, it's completely symmetric, so there shouldn't be a tendency to move left or right. So what's going on? So what we wanted to do is we studied a very simple reduced system. We considered a weakly forced, weakly coupled pair of oscillators that can fire in 1 to 2 resonance with a driver. And after doing averaging theory and things like this, you get an equation for theta 1, the phase of this oscillator, some nonlinearity that has to do with the 2N to 1 locking, and then coupling terms. All right? And we make a couple assumptions about F. We assume that because it's going at 2 to 1 locking, that there's 2 stable fixed points for this. One is the one corresponding to the odd cycle, one corresponding to the even cycle. We assume the coupling is 2π periodic, and the nonlinearity here is pi periodic. And we make a few other assumptions here that are reasonable. And take it as an example, f of phi is minus sine 2π. A priori, however, there's no such symmetry for H, the interaction function, the coupling. Okay? So it's not necessarily an odd function. So this thing will, if you do a chain of these guys, you can get a nice wave which goes in both directions. Here, pi takes over because pi and minus pi are the same thing. Here, 0 takes over. And if the coupling is too weak, neither guy can take over because this is a discrete system. So you can go to the continuum limit in this, all right, and you can get this nice reaction diffusion type equation in the continuum limit, but it has an extra term in here, an h double prime of 0 theta x squared. All right, now that still preserves symmetry, right? X and minus x are still symmetric. However, what you could, I thought I had more on this. Okay, so there actually is a lot more to this. I thought there was more on this, but I want to get to the flicker, which is more fun. In any case, basically what you can then do is you can prove that if H double prime is non-zero, that there's a wave that goes in either direction. Okay, it's not dependent on the sign of H double prime. There's just two different waves, one that goes with a positive direction and one that goes in the negative direction. And in particular, you can prove that very easily if H double prime is 0 by using Melnikov methods. All right, for those of you who are math guys. All right, so basically summarizing this thing, what we think is going on with contour phosphenes is that there's 2 to 1 resonance in the retina that confers bistability. There's coupling between these bistable domains, and there's either anisotropy in there or just the fact that there's this this extra term in here gives waves that propagate and gives rise to nice traveling waves that can move around on here where one contour takes over another. Now, the next thing I want to talk about harkens back to my PhD thesis. I didn't do flicker hallucinations then. What I did back in my PhD thesis was something called LSD, or mescaline-induced hallucinations. Those are illegal. Maybe not in Canada. I don't know. Canada lets you, right? You're allowed to do anything here, right? You're a bunch of socialists if you believe if you believe the south of the border guys, right? Anyway, this was actually being okay. I better cut with the American jokes, so they're not going to let me back in. Okay, so my original thesis was on that sort of thing, but recently I've been interested in less or more brain-friendly ways to induce these kinds of interesting patterns. All right, now here's an experiment you can do without any equipment at all. Take the heels of your hands and close your eyes, press them against your eyeballs. Okay, so as you press, at first you'll start to see little tiny flickering. Okay, and as your eyeball starts to ache a little more, that flickering will turn into these geometric patterns, sort of like checkerboards and honeycombs and things like that. And in fact, there's this remarkable, there's this really cool phenomena, and of course it's got a German name. I think it's called Morgenblitz, okay? And the Germans always have the great words like Schadenfreude, which is everybody's favorite word, right? I mean, who doesn't enjoy a little Schadenfreude every now and then? But, and Geistesblitz, and this is why I wish I, well, never mind. Anyway, in any case, if you just awake from a dream in the morning, okay, don't open your eyes immediately, but keep them closed and press against them, and you'll get these incredibly gorgeous, colorful, geometric patterns. Because you're just waking up from a dream, your brain is in this super active state, and you keep your eyes closed so there's no external stimuli coming in. All right? So what I think happens, and there's some recent work by Ken Miller and Dave Furster that has shown that the visual cortex, that's this part of your brain, for you math guys, in fact, this is a cool thing you can do also. Hit the back of your head really hard, and you'll see little flickering stars, okay? You've probably seen stars before, okay? You're activating your visual cortex there. It's not the best thing to do, but it will work, okay? Visual cortex, we think, sits in a very close to balanced state where the excitation and the inhibition just kind of cancel each other out. And there's a reason for that. You don't want to be at this really deep fixed point, because then it's really going to be hard for a stimulus to cause any kind of activation. But the cost for being at this balanced state is it doesn't take much to disturb the balance. All right? And there's many ways, small changes in the functional connectivity can induce spontaneous activity. For example, hallucinogens are a really easy way to do this. Pre-epileptic and pre-migraine auras, your brain just gets more and more excited. Sensory deprivation, Charles Bonnet syndrome is an example. And flicker. Okay, so what I want to talk about for the rest of the day is some work I've been doing on flicker hallucinations. And what's really cool about this is there's been some recent psychophysical data on this, which is really kind of cool because it fits in really nicely with something called symmetric bifurcation theory, which I just mentioned. Okay, so this is really one of the first writings on flicker hallucinations. And this is by Jan Purkinje, okay, or Purkinje. I don't know. I've seen about 20 different spellings of his name. You probably have seen even more, right? Don't they? There's always lots of them, okay? I think, is it the same dude that did the Purkinje cells in the cerebellum do? I think so. Okay. The lively mind of the child revels in the manifold. See, manifold. This is a math talk, okay? The manifold stimuli of the external world. Who does not remember, if only dimly, such games from that beautiful time? One of them which could keep us busy at a more serious age is as follows. I stand in bright sunlight with closed eyes and face the sun. Then I move my outstretched, somewhat separated fingers up and down in front of the eyes so they're alternately illuminated and shaded. This is way before video games, you see. So you had to do this sort of thing, okay? They didn't have TV then. You had to make it up yourself, all right? In addition to the uniform yellow-red that one expects with closed eyes, there appear beautiful regular figures that are initially difficult to define but slowly become clear. When we continue to move the fingers, the figure becomes more complex and fills the whole visual field, all right? So this is, as far as I know, one of the first instances, descriptions of flicker phosphenes or flicker hallucinations. Bright, diffuse, flickering light, I want to change that now to 5 to 20 hertz, okay? Because there's some recent data that shows that you can get patterns in lower frequencies. And I have a PhD, not a PhD student, I had an undergrad who was like a computer hacker, and he made me a set of goggles, which are really amazing, okay? They have ping pong balls, LEDs, and a microcontroller that you can program from a USB port on your PC to give all kinds of patterns of uniform flickering light into your visual field. You put these things on, and it's just great. Some people hate them, it makes them nauseous, but other people won't take them off, okay? So it just depends on how susceptible you are to flicker, okay? So this has a long history. Helmholtz, Eldridge Green in 1920 talked about lattice work and hexagons. J.R. Smithies, in a couple of papers in 57 and 58, subjects reported a variety of geometric forms, such as mosaics, checkerboards, and spirals. I love this. One subject enjoyed it so much that he expressed the conviction that they possessed the power of addiction, and one developed an active desire to go on looking at them, okay? If you have kids, you've got video games, you know exactly what I mean, okay? Max Noll in 1963 did flicker plus hallucinogens, and he had this really interesting model. Okay, I shouldn't say strange, it was an unusual model. The idea was that light came in, it rattled around here cyclically, and then came back exactly as the next beam of light came in. So it was kind of a resonance thing, which I think is the right answer. It's just not quite biologically correct. So here are some pictures of patterns that Purkinje drew when he was talking about there's some checkerboards and various and sundry hexagons, stripes, spirals, and curved patterns and things like that. These are more classic pictures that people have subsequently drawn. These are sorts of, this is a starburst type pattern, and there's a spiral. I don't have a bullseye up here. I'll show you a bullseye shortly. Paul Breslov, these are pictures from some simulations that he did. So now I'm going to get to form constants. I always have to say a little bit about form constants. This is a great book. Anybody that can get a hold of a copy of this, it's a really interesting book to read. It was written in the 1940s by Heinrich Kluver. The same guy that Kluver-Busey syndrome is named after. He was at University of Chicago. Unfortunately, when I got there, he was already, he was still alive, but I think he had like Alzheimer's before they knew there was Alzheimer's. But in any case, maybe he did too much mescaline, I don't know. But he wrote a series of, he wrote this book based on giving subjects mescaline. And in the appendix of this book, he talks about these things called form constants that everybody sees in the early stages of hallucinations. These could be drug-induced hallucinations, pre-migraine auras, flicker things. He talks about spirals and vortices, funnels and tunnels, cobwebs and filigrees, exploding light rays and mosaics. Now, there's some recent work by Fitch, 2008, he puts people in an fMRI machine, and then he lets them wear goggles with flickering light, and what he finds is, depending on what kinds of patterns they see, different parts of the visual cortex light up, okay? And so I he looks at different frequencies and different luminance of light, and basically this is the back of the brain, this is the visual cortex, both sides are lighting up, and therefore we suspect that the origin of these patterns is cortical and not retinal. In the previous part of the talk, I showed you retinal-type patterns. I think these are cortical. Now, to understand how you get these nice, beautiful patterns, you have to understand that there's a transformation from the retina to the cortex. Okay? And basically, here's a picture of the retina, or the eyeball, all right? And visual psychophysicists, for some reason, like to use A and E for azimuth and eccentricity, okay? Whereas mathematicians like to use rho and theta for polar coordinates, because that's all really is a polar coordinates. And there's a nice map from E, which is R, and A, which is theta, to cortical coordinates, all right? And these things look like this, and those of you who are will immediately notice that if E is larger than E naught, sufficiently larger than E naught, this looks like a log of E, and this looks like minus lambda times A. And that's just a complex logarithm. All right? So basically, this transformation is like the complex log. And if you apply this transformation to these nice geometric patterns, you get, in this case, horizontal stripes. In this case, you get diagonal stripes in cortical coordinates. So basically, these patterns that we see in these complex geometric patterns become very simple tessellations of the plane when mapped onto cortical coordinates. So psychophysics one, all right? Oh, I got to tell you a Hugh Wilson story, all right? When I was a grad student, all right, I was a subject for lots and lots of their experiments. You can go back and look in this, what's it called, Vision Research Journal, and you can find these charts that have BE on them, okay? I was a subject. You spent hours in this dark room looking at this green oscilloscope, all right? And then when you come out, it's wonderful. The whole world is rose-colored, all right? All right? And so it was sort of like, you know, a marvelous experience. Ah, yes, I see the world through rose-colored glasses, okay? And gratings everywhere. The staircase method, it's the most boring, well, it's not the most boring. At least it wasn't painful. But I didn't get paid either. You know, nowadays people get paid for that, right? I figure with the interest accrued, he owes me more than a dinner. Okay, anyway. So Sal and Billick recently published a paper in the PNAS about a year or two ago, where what they did was they were actually able to stabilize these patterns. Okay? And they report that most of their subjects saw either bullseyes or starbursts. In the only of one of the early psychophysics papers, Romoli in the late 70s or early mid 70s studied cycles per second here and threshold luminance. Okay? And what he found is this is the flicker. Luminance flicker thing, and that's just a monotonic increasing function, okay? The higher the frequency, the larger the luminance has to be before you can distinguish the flicker, okay? But you'll notice that monocular patterns, binocular patterns, and diffuse patterns all have a non-monotonic behavior to them, okay? There's a particular frequency in which the minimum luminance, the luminance is minimal. I tell all my PhD students, if you have something that's non-monotonic, you have a thesis. If it's monotonic, you don't. I mean, you can always have more money. So what, right? You can always be better looking, have more hair, right? It's when you hit the minimum or the maximum that it's interesting, okay? So This is interesting because now you can see there's certain frequencies in which people see the patterns best. You notice he didn't test too much below 20, 15 hertz. This is another bit of recent stuff, 2006, by Becker and Elliott in Consciousness and Cognition. Here, what I thought was very interesting is Romoli just looked at whether they saw patterns. This group actually asked them what patterns they saw, and they made histograms of them. So you see spirals and radial, that's the kind of bullseye patterns that I was talking about, or starburst patterns, and they mostly occur at the 20 hertz regime, okay? But you see geometric patterns, rectangles, and there's also some reporting of hexagons at much lower frequencies, okay? So, and then I talked to Vince Billick, who does these does experiments, and he said, yeah, and there's kind of this literature that, you know, people reported at low frequencies you see hexagons, and at higher frequencies you see these stripe-like patterns, and nobody has an explanation. Well, I'm going to explain it by symmetry. Okay, so let me summarize the experiments. Apparently, they're cortical in origin. At high frequencies, you get stripes. At lower frequencies, you seem to get squares and hexagons. So how can we model this? Well, spontaneous pattern formation is a spatial instability. All right, and guys probably know about that. Anybody here? Probably everybody in this room has taken a frying pan, put oil on it, and stuck it on your stove and looked at the neat little geometric patterns. No? You must have. You do bifurcation theory, right? Yeah. So, coupled with resonance in the time domain, a simple neural network with excitation inhibition should be able to do this. So, what's the simplest model? Well, I'll go to these extremely famous equations, even more famous than Hodgkin-Huxley, the Wilson-Cowan equations, okay? Okay, the Wilson-Cowan equations, or Grossberg equations, depending on who you talk to. No, these are the Wilson-Cowan equations, 1973, classic paper, everybody should read it. It's in the Biophysical Journal, I think, and then there's the Biological Cybernetics one in 74, which does some spatial stuff. All right, so this is a simple neural network, excitation and inhibition, self-excitation, self-inhibition, and then the inhibition inhibits the excitatory guy. So this is your standard activator-inhibitor system. Now, I want you to know something. Here, these are the null clines. That's the inhibitory null cline. That's the excitatory null cline. Notice that we're sitting on the middle branch of the null cline, okay? That's really, really, really important. If you don't sit on that middle branch, you don't get any kind of pattern formation or anything. I don't care what you do, you'll never get pattern formation unless you're in that middle branch. Now, what's really interesting is this recent work by Förster and Miller shows that during cortical upstates, you are on that middle branch, okay? So there seems to be good evidence that you sit there. So what happens if we couple a pair of these guys, all right, and we give them uniform light, all right? So there's a simple network of two coupled with uniform light. And what you find, if you do a simulation of a pair of them, is you get This is the period along here, okay? This is the period or the frequency. This is the period, okay? Nothing happens at this very high frequency. And then you get a bifurcation here. And then right here, this red bifurcation is the one I'm interested in, okay? And that red bifurcation, these two guys split apart, and they fire on alternate cycles. That's a pattern, right? One group is on, one group is off. So we've got a spatial pattern now. And you can do an amplitude period thing and find a regime here. And if you look at this amplitude period, there's that very nice resonance phenomena that you saw. this is okay, this is just a pair. So basically what's going on in this case is 2-to-1 resonance. There's a damped return to rest, mutual lateral inhibition encourages the out-of-phase solution, and the resonance at twice the frequency, and there's resonances at twice the frequency, and also at the frequency that's half, at the natural frequency, and I'm going to show you that in just a minute. Okay, so now that's just a pair of guys. So what about two dimensions? What happens in two dimensions? Well, pair shows the plausibility, but spatial frequency and patterns are completely undetermined. I can't tell hexagons from stripes because I've only got two damn neurons. All right? So coupled E and I cells with a spatially decaying coupling on a two-dimensional grid. So here is this network of 2D, okay? There's spatial coupling, excitatory and inhibitory coupling. Okay, so this is a two-dimensional integro-differential equation periodically forced. And what you find is just blew me away when I saw this, okay? Here's a period of 45 milliseconds and 55 milliseconds, and here's 110 milliseconds and 125 milliseconds. That's 8 hertz, okay? So this is 8 hertz and this is 9 hertz. All right, and this is, I can't do the division. This is around 20 hertz, somewhere around 20 hertz. All right, you'll notice at 20 hertz, you get stripes. And at 10 hertz, 8 to 10 hertz, you get hexagons, which is exactly what the experiment showed. All right, now what's interesting about these stripes is this is not a movie. I don't have a movie. I think I do have a movie. These guys alternate, okay? So this guy becomes this guy on every other cycle, all right? So this is indicative of something called a period doubling bifurcation, okay? This guy doesn't do that. It's foreground, background, foreground, background. The background is distinct from the foreground. Here, the background and the foreground arise from a simple shift, okay, in space. So in 1D, this is sort of what you get for amplitude versus frequency, and you can see that the patterns, the other thing I want to point out, which is really interesting too, is that you'll notice that this is a lower frequency, okay? This is a lower frequency, but it has a higher spatial frequency pattern. So the pattern is a higher spatial frequency when the light is at a lower frequency. All right, so that's another thing you see in the simulations. I don't know if anybody's done the psychophysics for that. I don't think that they've tried to test that. So here's a big picture, okay? And this is really, this was done by an undergrad using a graphics processing unit, a GPU on his computer, to do massively parallel simulations. There's thousands of simulations involved here, okay? So this is a period going from 20 milliseconds to 150 milliseconds. And this is an amplitude 0 to 3.5. And what you see is two regions, two islands, okay? This is the low-frequency island, and it always gives rise to hexagons. And this is the high-frequency island that gives rise to stripes. So here's a summary of the simulations. Hexagons at low frequency, stripes at high frequency. Frequency in space increases with frequency in time. I think I actually have that backwards. It decreases with frequency in time. So can we understand this? All right. So here's a way to understand it. Compute the spatially homogeneous periodic solution. All right. You can't write that down, but you can numerically compute the homogeneous spatial pattern by solving a boundary value problem, okay? So that's what I do. Then you use the translation invariance of the convolution curve to compute the monodromy matrix as a function of the magnitude of the wave number, okay? Because this is spatially isotropic, okay? So solutions to this are going to be e to the I k dot x. And so all we have to do, all that matters, is the magnitude of k, okay? So find critical values of beta for plus or minus 1, I had an appointment. I guess I missed it. Okay. Find critical values of beta for plus or minus one flow K multipliers. Okay. Some of you don't know what flow K multipliers are. It just has to do with periodic solutions to a dynamical system, and you look at the linearization of it. Okay. Track as a function of, say, amplitude and period. So this is basically what I did numerically. All right. So here's an example, all right, of a particular simulation. All right. So I'm looking, I've drawn three curves here. Okay. And it turns out for this system, you have this monodromy matrix. You can evaluate it at the end of the simulation, and you can look at the eigenvalues of that. Okay. Or you can look at something called the trace of this matrix, and when those curves cross certain ways, you can determine whether there's a plus one flow K multiplier, which means one-to-one resonance, okay, or a minus one flow K multiplier, which implies two-to-one resonances, or you can look for quasi-periodic solutions, which correspond to the determinant crossing 1. Well, the green curve's the determinant. It never gets anywhere close to 1. And if you look at this minus 1 guy crosses the 0 axis, that means it goes unstable for this particular range of wave numbers. Okay? This is at a period of 60. At a period of 110, you'll notice that the minus 1 stays bounded away from 0, and the plus 1 resonance goes through. So you get a plus one resonance at low frequencies and a minus one resonance in high frequencies. So now what I do is I track this point as a function of beta and as a function of a period, and I get this little regime here, okay, these islands, and everywhere in here it's unstable because this is where bifurcations occur. As I increase the frequency, I cross the minus one domain for some value of beta, okay? So every beta in here is unstable. And then what I can do is track these critical values, and you'll notice that I get two islands, a red island here and this big island here. I don't know if I have a picture that, yeah. So this is much more careful to 1D simulations, okay? So these green and blue are the islands I compute by looking at the stability of the monodromy matrix. These colored dots here correspond to simulations of the full model computing when there's patterns. And the amplitude of these tells you how big the pattern is. All right? So you can see these fit perfectly over there. The other thing I want to point out is what I've also shown here is along here is the wave number beta. And so you'll notice that as the period goes up, the wave number goes up as well. That's the spatial frequency increases with period, just like we saw in the simulations. Okay? So basically, this kind of analysis can explain the quantitative difference between the relationship between frequency and space and frequency and time. Now, stripes versus hexagons. This is for you. Why do you see stripes at high frequencies and hexagons at low frequencies? At high frequencies, there's a minus one flow K multiplier. That implies a kind of symmetry, a plus and minus symmetry, okay, in the normal form, okay? If you do an analysis near a bifurcation, you can compute things called normal forms, okay? There's a minus one flow K multiplier in space. This gives you a normal form. In particular, there are no quadratic terms in the normal form. Because of that, it turns out stripes will be selected in the normal form. So you automatically get bifurcation to stripes when you have that. You get that without, it's independent of the model. It doesn't matter what the model is. I showed you a model, but it doesn't matter. It will work with any model that you have. As long as it's a minus one, 2-to-1 resonance, you'll get stripes. At low frequencies, the +1 multiplier implies quadratic terms in the normal forms. Hexagons bifurcate subcritically, but turn around and become stable, so they become large amplitude patterns that you will get at low frequencies. So basically, at low frequencies, this flow K multiplier implies quadratic terms in the normal form, and hexagons are what you expect to be selected. So it's simply the fact that in high frequencies, you're getting period 2, you're getting 2-to-1 resonances, and you get stripes, and at low frequencies, it's 1-to-1 resonance, and you get stripes and hexagons. What's really cool is the domain shape doesn't much matter. My undergrad did some experiments on cortex-shaped domains, okay? So he solved these equations on 2D domains, and you can see, this is the high frequency, you get very nice stripes there, all right? Now, stripes of either orientation emerge. How are they consistent? For example, we don't see, when we get these patterns, you don't see bullseye, a half a bullseye on your eye, and then a starburst on the other half of your visual field. The whole thing is together. So we suggest that maybe, since stripes of either orientation emerge, they might be coupled across left and right hemifields. There might be some coupling. So if you couple along the midline, borders of V1, and it's known that neurons that are along that go to both hemifields, that turns out to be enough to lead to, see if this will work. You see, both of these are going exactly to the same pattern, okay? So they're nicely synchronized. This is a neat example of spatial synchronization, not temporal synchronization. By coupling, you get the stripes will always be the same orientation, and they'll be at the right phase with respect to each other. So yeah, this is just showing the development of the pattern. So, questions remain. This is a preliminary version of the goggles I told you about. He's got much cooler looking ones. I mean, not cooler, they're much, much smaller, much better now. So, what do different patterns of light do? What about color effects? How can we stabilize these patterns? And finally, let me acknowledge, on the first part of the talk, John Drover did a lot of the early simulations and some analysis of integral equation versions of the first set of equations. He's now at Cornell. Helen Parker is an undergrad, or was an undergrad. Now she's got a, she's working on her, she's a first year grad student at San Diego. She was part of our research training group with John Rubin. Michael Rule was at CMU as an undergrad, and he's the one that built the goggles and did those 2D simulations that I showed you. He's now, I think he's now at Brown or Yale, okay, doing a PhD in computational neuroscience. Matt Stoffregen, he did the one-dimensional simulations. He was a high school student when he did it, and now he's a second-year undergrad, but he's taking all grad courses now. He's one of these really smart kids. And finally, the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Mental Health. Thank you.